I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source, at the point where man and machine meet, women too, on the job. Right about half the jobs in the U.S. will be lost to computers and robots in the next 20 years. So your job is definitely in danger. But how about you? Maybe you're ready to graduate out of the workaday world. Even then, should we be sore that our brain work is being outsourced? Is our humanity being downsized? We've got two extraordinary guests. Ray Kurzweil, the prolific inventor and futurist. He says that on the accelerating track of technology, we're 15 years away from reverse engineering the human brain on the way to reproducing it and then improving it. Andrew McAfee in our studio is an economist at MIT who says that the maturing of smart machines, meaning smarter than we are, is going to change everything in this century, including us, people. We'll have vastly more wealth, probably more fun, much less work, but benefits skewed to people with advantages. I've got another question about humanity itself. As a moving force in the new economy, humans seem to be dropping down the way horses dropped down and out of farming when tractors took over. Are we putting human stewardship at risk? Literally, putting humans out to pasture with those horses. What jobs cannot be computerized, we all wonder. How about the parental reading of bedtime stories? We went over to the MIT Media Lab this week to meet furry little social robots trained for that job.
Hi, I am Paul. We are going to have so much fun together. I want to learn to read. I hope you can teach me some words. And I will tell the story. The story is called The Dragon Lost His Ball.
The goal is to have robots that are actually social, so we can talk to them. They look at your eyes, they can follow your gaze, they can also maybe understand your facial expressions. And here we're using social robots, which are plush characters and very cute, which children love, to try and interact in an educational settings with children. So we're trying to make the robot somehow teach the children some new vocabularies, how to read in a very fun and interactive way, just to have a more social interaction with robots.
This is really a creature, you know, it's like a different new category that opens in your mind. This is not a doll, because kids accept dolls for what they are, and this is not a human. This is something that you can turn on and have fun with, play with, and this is something you learn.
Thank you so much for teaching me these words. I am tired now. I think I will go to sleep. It was great playing with you. It would be wonderful to play again sometime. See you. Bye-bye.
Andrew McAfee of MIT is an economist of the work world. With Erik Brynjolfsson, he wrote The Second Machine Age. The first one was the Industrial Revolution, triggered by James Watt and his steam engine in Scotland in the 1770s. That marks the all-time sharpest turn in human productivity. Andrew McAfee, where are we now?
Chris, thanks for having me on the show. The point that Erik and I make in The Second Machine Age is that we feel like we're at a second great big turning point, great big bend in the curve of human history. If the Industrial Revolution was basically the story of us overcoming the limitations of our muscles, and like you say, that was a big deal for humanity. By a lot of measures, it was the biggest deal, the biggest story so far in human history. Our point is that what we are in the middle of doing now is overcoming the limitations of our minds, of our brains. That is going to be, to my mind, at least as big a deal as overcoming the limitations of our muscles.
Who's going to pay for it? I mean, what's the bad news here?
The bad news is that the journey from where we are now to a world where there's plenty of wealth and not that much drudgery or toil, that's the world I think we're headed toward. The challenge is making that journey a smooth and an inclusive one, as opposed to one with some unpleasant characteristics, wider gaps in between the rich and the poor, decreased opportunity, increased inequality. We see these things going on in the economy right now. They're not great. I'm worried about them. And so as we head deeper into the second machine age, let's figure out how to bring the people along with the amazing technological progress.
I mentioned the Instagram Kodak contrast, which of course I stole out of your book. That's a caution. Does that apply to other industries, other events?
It's an extremely vivid example of the pattern that we're seeing all over the place, which is twofold. There's a lot of disruption in the corporate world. There are these old-fashioned giants like Kodak that are gone, and these little bitty companies, super valuable, like Instagram. Okay, I don't see any huge concern there. Companies grow and they die. The bigger challenge is that Kodak employed a lot of people in Rochester.
Sustained the city. It was the city, including the Eastman School of Music and all those other benefits.
Led to a lot of good stuff in Rochester and around the world, and provided a lot of solid, stable, middle-class jobs for people. And one of the glories of American society for the 20th century has been a large, stable, prosperous middle class. It's really good news. The thing that really probably worries me the most is there's a lot of evidence that the middle class is getting hollowed out. And technological progress, we need to be honest, is one of the factors causing that to happen.
Yeah, it's a very big deal. From 150,000 employees to 15 that made Instagram. When did you start noticing this division that new technology was not building a new economy, it was destroying an old one and leaving an awful lot of people hanging?
You know, for a long time, I walked around with the classic economist view of the world, which is that technology always destroys jobs, industries, companies, and it always creates jobs and industries and companies. And for as long as we've had technology, that balance has been a positive one. There's more creation than the destruction. So I kind of walked around with that happy historical pattern in my head. Just in the past few years, when Eric and I started looking at a lot of the evidence and looking at a lot of examples of tech progress, it suddenly seemed to us like that balance might be tipping. And I lost that faith that the creation was always going to outweigh the destruction.
There's another side of the story entirely. Roughly speaking, what's so great about work anyway? And why are we mourning the disappearance of toil and labor and risk and danger? I always think of Ted Kennedy, the late Ted Kennedy, running for office the first time in a factory. Rich kid, obviously, and some worker on the line said, you know, they keep saying you've never worked a day in your life. And there was a sort of anxious pause. And then the guy said, let me tell you something, you haven't missed a damn thing. Why should we not be celebrating an opportunity to be, dare I say, our better selves, our dreamers, our romantics, our creators, et cetera? And how do we bring that opportunity?
Okay, those are two really different questions. I love the first part. There's a great science fiction writer who said, look, the goal should be 100% unemployment so we can play, so that we can go exercise our faculties, so we can go have this digital Athens, as the phrase that we use, this exalted society where people debate democracy and philosophy. And instead of an army of human slaves doing the heavy lifting of the economy, there is an army of machines and robots doing all that. That's a great vision. Let's try very hard to get there. The second question you ask is, what does that journey look like? And again, how do we make sure that it is not it's not terribly unpleasant for a lot of people? We don't leave a lot of folk behind or disenfranchise them on the way. That's the big question for the next generation or two.
Why do we know already? I'm also reminded that this promise of a world without work is an old one. I always, and everybody remembers that letter from John Adams to his wife, saying, you know, I study diplomacy, war, so that my children can study astronomy and practical arts, so that their children can study poetry and porcelain, he said.
Did he?
But the idea of being liberated from work is an old promise, never been fulfilled.
Never. So for 200 years, allegedly smart people have been proclaiming the end of work. And for 200 years, and this includes one of my intellectual heroes, John Maynard Keynes, wrote an essay in the 30s where he very accurately predicted how much the economy would grow in about a century, and was really inaccurate about how that would leave us. And he thought we would all live like – it was going to be all Downton Abbey all the time. We would just work a little bit and then fox hunt and go to dinner, and that's just not the world that we've created. There's a lot of work left. So your question is, what, if anything, is different this time? It's a great question. The honest answer is we don't know for sure. But suddenly to me, when we've got technologies that can drive cars with no human input, when we have a phone that can listen to what we're saying, figure out what we want, and deliver it to us immediately with no human intervention, when the world's best Jeopardy player is no longer a human being but a computer, when they are demonstrating these abilities in image recognition and natural language processing and induction, just go down the list of really tough challenges, we're seeing amazing progress in those things. One of my favorite quotes is is from Hemingway talking about how a person goes broke. And he says, it's gradually and then suddenly. Our progress on a lot of these really thorny problems in computer science has been really gradual, really unimpressive. And then honestly, just in the past half dozen years, it has taken off and the progress is now very sudden. That's what tells me that this time might be different.
Who's winning? Who's losing so far? I mean, it's astonishing. Yeah. Physical therapists, apparently, or personal trainers will have jobs forever. Maybe people reading x-rays, radiologists looking for irregularities, they may be outdone by computers. So how does it actually work?
So I got to break that question down into two parts. When you ask who's winning and who's losing, it depends on if you're thinking of us human beings as consumers or as laborers. If you're thinking about us as consumers, we're all winning. We all have access to more volume and variety and quality and lower prices. I'll steal one of Ray's lines. I hope he's not going to get mad at me. He makes this great observation that a kid with a connected smartphone today has access to more information than the President of the United States did 20 years ago. I think that's accurate, and it's amazing. So when it comes to us as consumers, of entertainment, of communications, of medicine, of you name it, we're all worlds better off because of tech progress. The old joke among economists is that tech progress is the only free lunch we believe in.
Is there a safe job out there for you, for me? Not for me, I'm sure.
Radio host will be safe for a while, as long as there's radio.
Coming up, the man who can see the day when science will put your thinking process on a silicon chip to be alive forever. That's the futurist, inventor, the transhumanist, Ray Kurzweil. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about jobs and technology. On the digital revolution and the end of work, with the labor economist Andrew McAfee, who wrote The Second Machine Age, which is multiplying our mind power, he says, the way industrial machines multiplied our muscles. Ray Kurzweil, so good to have you on our program. You're the
great
emerging.
To be with you again, Chris.
Thank you. The emerging world is in your head, Ray. You're a world famous inventor, now the chief engineer at Google, the very embodiment of the technological quest. How do you describe where we're going, where we're at?
Well, I think the trends that Andrew talked about are well underway, but I would characterize the implications a little differently. If I were a prescient futurist in 1900, I would say, okay, a third of you work on farms and a third of you work in factories, but I predict in 100 years, by the year 2000, that'll be 3% and 3%, and that is what happened. Today it's 2% and 2%, and everybody would go, oh my God, we're going to be out of a job. And I'd say, well, don't worry, you'll get jobs on digital radio, designing websites, new chips, applications for mobile devices, and nobody would have any idea what I'm talking about. We actually have more jobs today. About 100 years ago, one-third of the eligible population was working. Today, it's two-thirds. The new jobs pay roughly eight times as much in constant dollars. We had no social safety net before 1930. It wasn't because society wasn't liberal enough. There just wasn't enough money to do it, and so we put Social Security in place, and we've been building that social safety net ever since. And most importantly, the new jobs are more gratifying. More people sort of get some sense of their identity and sense of worth from their employment. 1900, you were happy if you could do hard labor just to support your family. And we're not fully there yet, but I like to say that I retired when I was five because decided I wanted to be an inventor, and so I've been pursuing my passion ever since. I was interested when the French went on strike to protest raising the retirement age from 60 to 62, and I'm thinking, gee, they must really not like their jobs. So I think that's the goal, is to actually have a passion for what you're doing, to be able to do what will give you gratification. We're not fully there, but we're definitely moving in that direction. Two-thirds of jobs today in the United States have to do with creating knowledge of some sort. In some way, there are information jobs. Almost all of those jobs didn't exist 25 years ago. You say that, you know, half, you quoted that half the jobs, according to one analysis, will be computerized within 20 years. That was true in 1900. That was true in 1800 when the Luddites, which a society formed from the weavers, who had a sort of business model, a trade that they passed down from generation to generation for hundreds of years, and suddenly machines were coming out. One machine with one operator could do the work of 20 people, and they said, well, employment's going to go away, and it's just going to be enjoyed by an elite. And indeed, those jobs went away. But whole new jobs were created. Suddenly, the common man and woman could have more than one shirt. They could have a whole wardrobe. There were new industries formed. And employment has generally gone up. We continue to destroy jobs at the bottom of the skill ladder, add jobs at the top of the skill ladder. They pay more. They're more gratifying. And more of them actually satisfies people's passions.
Can I just interrupt you, Ray, to say those are changes out there in a sense, but you are also talking about changes in us. You've hooked me and millions of others on this word singularity, a moment out there, maybe 20, maybe 30 years, when perhaps with Google glasses and other things, we will be as much techno as we are bio.
Well, it actually builds on the point I was just making, because if we create new jobs at the top of the skill ladder, we have to increase our skills. So one way we've done that is with education. We had 50,000 college students in 1870. We have over 12 million today, and we have a whole industry of people that teach them and support that. We also make ourselves smarter with our brain extenders, our devices. I mean, today I can have a small group of three or four people in a matter of weeks accomplish what used to take years with a group of 100 people. But it doesn't mean that we get the same work done with less people. We're actually accomplishing more. Our standards change. We have, I mean, look at the entire web. None of that vast amount of knowledge, tens of billions of pages of intelligent information existed at all, you know, a mere 20 years ago. So our horizons continue to change, and we're going to increase our skills by making ourselves smarter. Now, you know, most of these devices are not inside our bodies and brains today. A few of them are. You know, Parkinson's patients or deaf people have implants that help them overcome these disabilities.
Ultimately, wear glasses, yeah.
Ultimately, these devices will go inside our bodies and brains. I think that's an arbitrary distinction. You know, that's decades away, but that's going to be a continuation of basically increasing our skills. So it's not going to be us versus the machines. We are going to enhance our abilities with technology. That's been the purpose of technology ever since we started it.
What is it that we are becoming? I want you to speak to your transhuman piece, Ray Kurzweil. What's the transhuman?
Well, we are overcoming our physical and biological limitations. And, you know, we've been doing that for a long time. Our life expectancy was 19 1,000 years ago. It was 37 in 1800. So we're extending life. I think that's going to go into high gear as we get to the more mature phases of the biotechnology revolution. And we're making ourselves smarter. As I said, I think it's an arbitrary distinction whether the brain extender is in our hands, and our brain directs our fingers to access, you know, this world of knowledge, as Andrew quoted a few minutes ago, or if it's actually directly inside our brains. I mean, that's a few decades away, but that'll be a continuation of this process. So to say that, you know, some fraction, according to this one study you quoted, half of the jobs will go away in 20 years, that's always been true. I mean, the majority of jobs that exist today didn't exist a quarter century ago. So that's always a political issue, because the Luddites look around and says, well, Mary's going to be out of a job because of this new machine that just came out, and John's going to be out of a job because of a new machine I heard is coming out in a year. And indeed, those jobs did go away. And you couldn't describe, don't worry, there's going to be these new jobs. you couldn't describe them because those jobs hadn't been invented yet. And there were industries that hadn't been invented yet. I mean, look at the number of people that contribute to the 20 billion web pages we have today. Those jobs didn't exist 20 years ago.
A lot of them, remember, don't pay a dime. But I want to just remember something, Ray, that I got to know
That's not true. I mean, companies do business over the Internet, and, you know, the Internet supports a vast fraction of our economy.
Fair enough. I was a small quibble. I just want to remember that when I first got to know you somewhat, it was 30 years ago, you were a technologist then and distinguished, but you just also invented the Kurzweil piano, a synthesizer that sounded awful damn close to a Steinway. You'd invented the reading machine that became Stevie Wonder's talking book, for which he is eternally and movingly, if I may say, grateful to you. So I knew you from the start as the child of artists, a man of music, of essential humanity, whatever that is. I wonder how you just reconcile the human and the transhuman, the natural born product and the improved. Maybe
I mean, you mentioned my father. I mean, let's take that as an example. I mean, he was a composer. He could not hear his compositions without having arguments with funders who would fund him to hire an orchestra so that for the first time he could hear an orchestral composition. I mean, today a kid in her dorm room can hear orchestral composition, you know, on her notebook computer. So our ability to be creative and to create new knowledge has been vastly extended. Hmm. Another important point is we're creating the technologies of abundance, to quote the title of Peter Diamandis' book. We'll be able to print out clothing in the 2020s with three-dimensional printers, and there'll be, you know, open-source designs you can download for free and print out clothing at pennies per pound. We will still spend money for proprietary designs with the latest hot designer. And the economy is going to become a coexistence of proprietary forms of information and free open-source forms. The open-source information is a great equalizer. So today, you know, there are millions of songs and books and movies that you can watch legally for free, but people still spend money for, you know, to read Harry Potter or see the latest blockbuster. And that's going to be the nature of the economy. But we're moving up Maslow's hierarchy. Our basic needs for food and shelter and clothing and so on are going to be increasingly easy to meet and can be met with a small fraction of our economic output. But meanwhile, we move up to, you know, want jobs that provide gratification and actualization and creativity, and our ability to do that is going to continue to increase. You know, we were happy if we could just buy food a century ago.
Andy McAfee, Stump the Inventor.
No, not at all. Ray is doing a great job of articulating the abundance that comes from technological progress. And it's one of the two central facts of technological progress. It's really important not to lose sight of it. And I agree with a huge amount of what Ray just says. Where I'm a little more skeptical is the there's nothing to worry about here after a transition. Everything is going to be fine because everything has been fine with jobs and wages. I agree that that's been the historical pattern. And the point that we can't anticipate the jobs of tomorrow or next decade is absolutely spot on. What we do know, though, is that there are some trends going on that are worrying. And they're not trends that just come up in the Great Recession. And they're not trends that are just of the last 10 years or so. So for a couple decades, the middle class has been getting hollowed out. And Ray talks about this happy phenomenon of high-skilled, very rewarding jobs being created. That's true. The greater majority of jobs have been created at the absolute low end of the skill ladder. These are typically less well-paid, less prestigious, less fulfilling jobs in a lot of ways. We know that the amount of total GDP going to capital versus labor has been favoring capital increasingly. That's not just a recent trend. We know that most the wages for all American workers below the level of a college education have been going down for at least a couple decades, and fewer than 40% of American workers have that college education. So the reason I can't be as uniformly optimistic as I hear Ray being is because I see these trends in the data. I don't see anything that's magically about tech progress that's magically going to reverse them.
Ray Kurzweil, what's the answer to the basic distributional problem here, not only of the wealth, but of the benefits, the joys?
You know, I think you, Chris, touched on one aspect of that, which is, you know, what's so great about work? I think we need to redefine the nature of work, and partly that's mm-hmm. been happening. I mean, we have, you know, jobs now that involve the creation of knowledge, and that's actually the majority of the workforce.
Let me jump in on that. The majority of jobs, another way to say that is that they're fairly routine information processing jobs. These are more customer service rep than they are novelist, for example. And those jobs are squarely in the sights of the kind of automation we see today and especially tomorrow.
You say, Andy, it is interesting.
Well, but we had almost no jobs like that in, you know, a century ago. There were, you know, 50,000 college students at the end of the 19th century. And
Ray, I agree with you about the historical pattern, but you have to admit there are trends in the data and the evidence. They're not just of the past couple of years, and they're grounds for concern.
Ray Kurzweil.
Well, we had almost no one benefiting from the type of jobs that give you gratification very recently in human history. So that percentage is changing, it's increasing rapidly, and we have, for example, very few people could afford education. We had very few positions in college. Now it's much more extensive, but moreover, we're going to have a major revolution where people can get high-quality education at almost no cost.
I completely agree with that. And what we're learning so far, and I hope this changes, is that trend toward education is not yet a rising tide that floats all boats. It's what I would call a diamond detector. If there's a kid out there who's got the smarts and the tenacity and the motivation to go educate herself very, very deeply, she can do that. It's not yet a mass phenomenon.
Ray Kurzweil.
I mean, we're going to have to redefine the nature of work. We're going to be able to meet the material needs, which was a large purpose of work, very easily for everyone. We need to actually create markets or the whole industrial system doesn't work. So it has an incentive to to make wealth available.
I'm with you on all that. I think we're also going to need to re-examine some of our distribution questions. There's this stuff called money still has a really important role in society, and how are we going to make sure that people have enough of it to buy the stuff that still costs money? That's going to become a more pressing issue.
Yeah, but I mean, in the 2020s, you'll actually be able to live quite well, you know, without a lot of money, because we'll be able to print out clothing, food, modules to snap together a house, communication, education will all be extremely inexpensive and accessible. And so people will have the opportunity to seek their passion and spend time trying to figure out what that is. And have the resources to do it.
I agree that we're going to see very little and less over time absolute physical misery, starving in the streets. I do still think there are things that are expensive, are going to continue to be expensive in the short to medium term. And ignoring that seems a little blithe to me.
Ray, could I just ask, I mean, I'm going to take your word for it that we will figure out a way to through a guaranteed income or something, you know, get the benefits and the currency out there. But this is a different sort of question. What is happening to our humanness, flawed as it is, as it always will be? But is it not being discounted? And maybe are we not being, as humans, demoted, like the horse when the tractor arrived on the farm?
I mean, you referred to transhumanism, which I think is an unfortunate term because it implies we're going to transcend our humanity, and we're actually stuck with a lot of bad terms like artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. It implies it's not real intelligence. But I would prefer to talk about transcending our biology, in fact, specifically our biological limitations, and that's really what this technology promises. Our humanity, which is being creative and changing who we are, that's actually going to become enhanced. Being creative, being able to have relationships, having transcendent experiences of that type.
I think this
technology
is
technology facilitates that, and we're transcending things like disease, which are really limitations of our biology.
This is a really fundamental point that Ray's making. Our humanity is not our biology, and I don't feel this great threat to our humanity here. You played the clip of a strange new doll that reads to kids. I say fantastic. Think about a kid with severe autism or Asperger's who needs a huge amount of very interactive therapy to improve his skills. That's draining and very expensive in today's world. Let's give some of that to machines. These machines are not substitutes for each other. They are complements.
I might argue with you on that.
Speaking of therapy and counseling, very few people in today's society have the opportunity to get a counselor or some kind of therapist, yet almost everybody could benefit from that,
right, have
some guidance in their lives. And that's an occupation for people that can be amplified by technology with things like interacting with computer-assisted instruction and so forth. So there's lots of work that would be very beneficial, like providing everyone in the world with a counselor to guide them in life, that just isn't being done today.
Somebody's got to be out there counseling the parents who can read to their kids and not give it up to a machine. That's another whole argument. We're talking about jobs and technology. Coming up, what drives this engine of techno-transformation, really? I'm Christopher Lydon with Ray Kurzweil and Andrew McAfee. We're talking about machines smarter than we are and about the end of work. Here is a little flashback of the way a lot of us still think about workplaces and work. Strangely enough, this old-fashioned example still works and thrives on Park Street in Somerville, Massachusetts, at the Peter Forg Machine Shop, fifth generation since 1881, making metal washers, for example, for machinery.
Pretty much, you know, we're a manufacturing company of metal stampings, and metal stampings is pretty much punching holes in metal. We have history going back to World War I. We actually made trench helmets.
It's changed huge over the years. I think we do more work now with five guys production than we did with 20 guys years ago.
They fill a niche. I mean, this is an old product that doesn't go to China because we don't make a million parts. And so it's like a family business.
To me, it's the best trade in the world. You know, you get to create things and do things with your hands, think. Every day is a different project to work on.
I love it. It's like building a model airplane. When you're done, you love it. You don't want to even give it away.
You know, I don't mind getting my hands dirty. You know, the physical work keeps me in shape and keeps me going. And the thing I like is at the end of the day, you can see what you've done.
So there they are in the movie version of a good old factory, Ray Kurzweil, and they still think that there will always be jobs for tool and die guys. Speak to them. That work nostalgia.
Well, I mean, a lot of our creativity is manifest in physical things. And if you look at factories today, people are very skilled and are still taking pride in the physical products they create. We're going to need physical products. We'll have more and more powerful tools to do that. And more people will be involved in the creative aspects of that, of designing them and refining them and not repairing them. We are, you know, continuing to increase the level of creative and intellectual content of the products that we create. If you look at products that are created in factories today, they're immensely more knowledge rich than products a century ago.
And the only reason those jobs have not gone away is because, as that guy said, they can do more work with a five now than they did with 20 in the past.
Right.
That's what keeps those kinds of manufacturing tasks from going over to low-wage countries like China. The only way to keep them around is via productivity increases. And the only real way to get those productivity increases is with tech progress.
But still, you know, we have only 2% of our population – in the United States working in factories. And
while our industrial output has done nothing but go up year after year, it's a pure productivity story.
Right, and it's the same thing on farms. We have 2% of the population working on farms, and we have fantastic productivity. And so those are positive trends. And in fact, the number of jobs is greater because we've created new types of jobs, and we've enhanced ourselves through education and now through brain extenders, even if most of them are not yet inside our bodies and brains.
The number of jobs in absolute terms is bigger, but so is our population. The percentage of working age people with a job is at a 30-year low.
So stand by. Charles Derber is on the phone. He's a sociologist at Boston College. Charlie Derber, are we describing a world that you want to live in?
My concern is really the fact that we're talking about this without the majority of the conversation ever having participated in it. And it sort of feeds into a concern that has always bothered me about technology, which is the assumption that it moves forward sort of its own accord outside of the sort of social and political domain. It seems to me that, you know, the most urgent need right now is to get the population at large involved in a conversation that can help us choose and guide the technologies that work for society at large. I'm very sympathetic to a lot of Andrew's reservations about the people who are going to be left behind. I think their voice is not being heard. I think, by the way, there's another element here that hasn't been mentioned in regard to the jobless future, which is that it's not necessarily related to technology at all. I mean, we're seeing, I think about 60% of the adult population is now in the labor force. A very large number of people are not because they've given up. And a large number of the people that Ray was describing who are in school are there. I know this because I see them every day, because they feel they can't find jobs. And when they go through 4 master's degrees, and they're not going to find them again. But the point I'm trying to make is that much of the reason for the current joblessness, even before the technological revolution has really moved in the direction that Andrew and Ray are talking about, we've got a structural, political, and economic system which is basically hollowing out, to use Andrew's phrase, a large percentage of the working and middle classes in the United States. And I think this has to do with political decisions that have been made by corporations who are looking for short-term profit. And
like what political decisions, Charlie?
Well, I think there's been a broad decision to essentially disinvest in the United States. I don't mean this in a conspiratorial way, Chris. I don't mean that, you know, the Business Roundtable has gotten together and CEOs have decided. But I mean that the logic around which the economy works is driven by profit. And I think technological decisions are driven by profit and pretty short-term concepts of profit. Yeah.
Charlie, what resonates with me is this mystery of where the whirlwind comes from and how it's directed. The bumper sticker in my brain, let me just say, is a version of the one that says question authority. Mine says question technologism, the idea that technology itself is a prime mover, a force unto itself.
Trying to say in two ways, a lot of the negative problems that we're facing have nothing to do with technology. They have to do with the way the political and economic system are operating, and the fact that large numbers of people are marginalized from making any decisions about that. And the second thing is that I think Americans have a kind of magical view of technology, which is being reinforced a little bit in the conversation, which is that it's simply inevitable, that there's sort of an internal logic of technological development. And my own view is that, you know, technology has always been shaped by political and social forces. And if we look around societies today, I mean, take the issue of the environment and climate change. Some societies are doing a great deal more with technological development of public transportation or wind or solar.
I was just going to say, Charlie, I mean, and I put this to you, Ray, what drives and what directs this energy? Frankly, for me, a robot that reads bedtime stories would be way, way down on the list behind infrastructure, for example. But what is your sense of
well, I mean,
the deeper impulse?
that project that reads bedtime stories is a, you know, worthwhile academic experiment. But what drives technology is the marketplace, and it's not just, you know, some board of directors that has a plan to boost short-term profits. Products that succeed in the marketplace are the ones that survive, and that's driven actually by a very fine-grained democracy. So, you know, companies like Google or Facebook have to meet the needs of literally billions of people to be able to have their products accepted. And we are, you know, continually improving our ability to meet people's basic needs, whether it's, you know, getting to a location on time, ordering a pizza, finding out information at a dinner conversation, and the myriad of other needs that we couldn't even do 5 or 6 years ago. I'm reminded of Dickens' line, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, and you can certainly point to social pressures and people who are very concerned or worried or in distress in today's world. You know, read Thomas Hobbes or Charles Dickens or what life was like a couple hundred years ago. It was incredibly desperate. You know, 99% of the population lived in desperation, on the brink of disaster from an all-too-common health problem. Life expectancy was 37. So, you know, we tend not to remember what life was like, say, 6 years ago when people weren't even using social networks or wikis like Wikipedia, which we've become dependent on, or blogs.
Chris, to answer your question,
200 years ago.
Technological progress is driven by this extraordinarily decentralized system of innovators and entrepreneurs responding to incentives and working within constraints. And it yields the kind of landscape of technology that we have here. Now, our caller said it's not a democratic process. It's absolutely not a democratic process, nor should it be. Who would have voted for an online encyclopedia that has no professional editorial staff and where anybody can edit anything or edit anybody else's edits? That's ludicrous, except it's Wikipedia. Tech progress is also not subject to the whims of a centralized Politburo of any kind, which is fantastic again. We try that, and it's a terrible idea. I live in Cambridge. Cambridge tried really hard a little while ago, to make Uber, this ride-summoning service, illegal in the city. What a terrible idea. I took an Uber car to get here. My driver is a IT project manager who was laid off from his job and unable to find another one, and Uber is the only way he can pay his bills. So the point is that technological progress is this very distributed, very decentralized activity. We should not change that. If we're worried that tech is racing ahead and leaving some people behind, the answer is not to try to channel or slow down technology. It's to increase the speed of our other institutions to help the people keep up.
And by the way, this whole entrepreneurial sector almost didn't exist when I started my first major business over 40 years ago. In 1974, total amount of high-tech venture capital in the United States was $10 million. That's a small deal today. Today it's, you know, in the many billions of dollars, and we have many people. This is another source of activity. I don't know if you'd even count them as employed, but who are you know, pursuing some very creative idea and spending and being very passionate about it. And that's another form of, you know, quote-unquote employment.
Except that it doesn't have paycheck and health care and benefits with it. It's another form of productive activity, absolutely.
Stand by. Sarah Jaffe is on the phone from New York. She is the host of Dissent Magazine's podcast. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being there. How does a worker make it in this world?
Well, I mean, I could tell you how I make it in this world, but that's another question. But what I do for a living is, in fact, talk to people about what they do for a living. And so, you know, I think it's worth asking whether people are attached to their jobs, whether people are attached to having a job or anything else. But we should also remember that the jobs that we think of as today's good jobs or as yesterday's good jobs, even those factory jobs that we were talking about, became good jobs because the people who had them organized to make them better. They didn't just become good jobs because working in a factory automatically pays better than driving an Uber car. they became good jobs because people demanded that they become better jobs. People also organized for, in fact, shorter working hours. The 40-hour work week came about because of worker organization.
What would unions, specifically of the workers that are still organizable, what would their vote be?
All workers are organizable. We just have to have a legal process that fits what jobs look like today as opposed to what jobs looked like 50 years ago.
And if we find aspects of our current system heartless or unfair or inequitable, by all means, let's change them. My point, though, is we need to resist the temptation to start picking technologies and say, good one, good one, bad one. Let's shut that one down. The distributed nature is what gives us the kind of progress that we're seeing. It's what grows the pie.
Ray Kurzweil, your turn, especially on the democratic questions here.
Well, we have a very fine-grained democracy. Facebook had a couple of years ago introduced a new set of privacy policies, and their users, none of whom perhaps who could understand it themselves, but with the wisdom of crowds, understood it very quickly, and they had certain objections, and Facebook very quickly changed them in response. These large companies, you might say they're very influential, but actually they're very dependent on their users, and
that's not a democracy. That's a market. I think we just need to use the right terms there. But companies and markets respond to the voice of their customers.
There's so many users. I mean, almost everybody is a user. So they really do have profound influence on these products. A market is a democratic process, particularly if the customers are not just a few well-heeled people.
It's a multi-voiced one. We don't give everybody a vote.
Ray Kurzweil, could I be verge on the personal? What did you tell your kids about finding their way as workers, as individuals in this incredibly fluid world? I mean, what was your version of the famous line in The Graduate, Plastics? I mean, what's the simple?
Well, it really is find your passion. That's what my parents told me, and so my daughter is a very talented writer and illustrator, and so she wrote a graphic novel. My son is very interested in business and technology, so he's a successful venture capitalist, and we've always supported their following their passion, and that's what you should do with children. Some have a very clear passion. I had a passion for technology and being an inventor. My father had a passion for music. My mother had a passion for art. With some children, it's not so clear, so you expose them to lots of things.
We should also keep in mind that it sounds like the Kurzweils were an extraordinarily gifted and talented family. I'm worried about the opportunities, the economic opportunities for a mid-skilled, mid-educated knowledge worker in the economy that we're heading into.
Aren't we all concerned about the middle? Thank you, Ray Kurzweil. Thank you, Andrew McAfee. Thanks also to Charlie Derber and to Sarah Jaffe. There's lots more on our website, including videos, stories, dispatches from a world with less and less and more of everything. Visit us at radioopensource.org. We're going out on the song Leisure, the band XTC's lament for a jobless society. Our show was produced by our irreplaceable robots, Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, and our engineer, George Hicks. Kunal Jasti, who's smarter than all of us, imagined this show and has put himself out of a job to go back to Columbia University. Thank you, Kunal. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.